This week on Writers, Inc.
I think you need to query agents. If you get a bunch of rejections, I think it's important to figure out why they're rejecting you and see if it's a problem that can actually be fixed, because a lot of times it can be. You know, if you're getting a ton of rejections, there's a reason. And if you can weed that out of the book, that's going to obviously make the book that much better. I don't think anybody should self-publish or indie publish unless they could have gone the traditional route and just choose not to.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm J.P. Reinflesch.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to the live episode of Writers, Inc. So full disclosure, like I keep looking off to the side, I've got a contractor that's working on the addition in our house right now. I think I told you when we built this thing, I added a couple of those hidden like bookcase doors. So one of them is on a bathroom in there, and the other one leads from the addition into the main part of the house. I guess with like the change in temperature and stuff, the wood's been swelling and shrinking or doing whatever, but like this guy had to come back in and adjust them. But he just got himself locked in the room, like the door closed and like he couldn't open it from the inside because
the lock
is on the outside. So like I'm watching him on the security camera because I want to make sure he doesn't actually do that again. And he knows the camera's there. So if I see somebody doing one of these, then I might need to bolt and go put my contractor out of the addition, I guess.
Always with the caveats,
the short version.
Perfect.
You always have to have some out.
Yep.
This is what happens when you add a bookcase door to your house or two of them.
So this is a room without a handle on the inside. I see how it is, Janie. Okay. We'll chat about that later.
They weren't in there yet, right? When you guys came to visit, that was still under construction.
Yeah, it was there when it was kind of in shambles, but I went through the bookcase. Okay. When I came to visit.
Yeah. So there's a handle on one side and it looks like a door, and then it looks completely like a bookcase on the other side. But they both have locks in them, and like the locks are turned off, but I guess because of the way the wood is swelled or whatever, the lock is still engaging. So like I had to go from the other side of the door and basically manually release the lock to let him out. So I think he blocked it with something, but like if the door closes again, he might lock himself in there again.
So this is clearly promotional material for JD's next escape room thriller.
Yeah.
So
it's a locked room mystery.
Get out of Barker's house.
The charcuterie door.
Get out of Barker's house.
Perfect.
All right. Do we want to jump right into the news?
Well, let's jump into the news so we have time to take questions.
I'm game. So in the news, Novel Beginnings. Pro Writing Aid has launched, quote, Novel Beginnings, a $95,000 global contest for unrepresented fiction writers who have not yet published a novel with an established publisher. Entrants submit the first 5,000 words of a fiction manuscript, with one grand prize winner receiving $50,000 and up to 9 additional writers awarded $5,000 each. Just a heads up that there is a $20 entry fee if you are not a member of Pro Writing Aid.
All right, so who signed up?
I will be signing up.
I don't think I'm eligible.
Yeah, but I think I'm going to.
You're not eligible, Kevin. You can't have published.
Well, that's true. I thought it was just if you weren't represented.
Oh, I think it said unpublished, so I don't know.
It says not yet published a novel with an established publisher.
Oh, interesting.
That leaves it open for indie authors.
How do you qualify established publisher?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's why I haven't done it yet, because I got an email out to Chris to ask him some questions about it. So, and also to find out if there's a way for me to get on the inside track and win. That's
right.
That's what I'm really after.
Are you going to sign up?
I don't think I qualify.
No, you don't, because
No.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
That's okay. But money is always good.
I've got a brief window in which I qualify.
Yeah, I don't know.
Take it.
I would have to look, because I have the rights agreements for audio. So, who knows?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, you just announced your deal yesterday.
Well, JP, let me ask you a question. Like, you've been doing pretty well selling your books just on TikTok, right? Like, do you need an agent at this point? Like, do you even want one?
I actually have one. So,
oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, I have one with the Knight Agency, who are the ones that did the Heated Rivalries agreement for HBO, and they do the subsidiary rights for audio. So,
is this something that would even interest you, or you like feel like this is?
I haven't even looked at it, to be honest, so I don't know.
I've seen a lot of people over the last few years, you know, they just basically starting as indie authors and like an agent and going that traditional route's like not even on their radar anymore.
Yeah. I've considered the trad route. I think I would like to do it for at least one book or two, but I really do like the process and stuff that I'm doing right now. So
I like the $50,000.
Yeah.
Just a thing. I have a thing for $50,000. Just a just little a thing. Quirk of mine.
It's just so weird, so rare. Nobody saw that coming.
So weird, so rare. Next up, Washington Post Book World. The Washington Post announced mass layoffs affecting roughly one third of its staff, citing financial pressures, and confirmed that its book department will be shut down. The closure ends a short rival of Book World, which was relaunched in 2022.
Yeah. That's a bummer. It's always sad to see newspapers no longer having book sections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like that's always the first to go. Like, you know, they always cut the books first, which.
Yeah.
So dumb.
I think I read they were cutting a lot of their podcast stuff, too. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much they do, but like.
So what you're saying that seems is less... there's an opening.
Yeah.
There might be. Hey, and if you win that contest, then you can have that on the
If I win the contest. Yeah.
Opening of your cover letter.
That's right. Well, since all these aren't going to exist anymore, I'm just going to put them on my resume as things that I did.
You might want to have Alex edit that out.
CEO of Washington Post Book World. Prove me wrong. We got more stories here. We got a couple more stories here. So can book streaming save the literacy crisis? Book streaming is emerging as an unexpected literacy tool, with top creators live streaming themselves, reading books aloud, modeling the act of reading rather than just talking about it. Probably doing much better than I'm doing. The trend taps into a real crisis. Fewer than half of Americans read even one book last year. And Gen Z reports especially low enjoyment of reading, raising concerns about attention spans, comprehension, and reliance on summaries or AI shortcuts. The appeal of top creators lies in visible imperfection, mispronouncing words, pausing to look things up, and reflecting on how reading helps them communicate better, making reading feel accessible rather than academic or elite. The movement is gaining cultural validation, suggesting that live stream reading could normalize books within digital first youth driven spaces. I like this, I think. And normally I'm opposed to things that normal people do online, but I
kind of like this idea.
I'm guessing you're good at it though. Like I read a book to my daughter every night, and like I am the worst reader when I've got to read something out loud. And like I've done tons of, you know, appearances at bookstores and stuff like that, and like I stopped reading my own books like probably a month into the very first book tour. Like that just wasn't going to happen, because I read too fast. I stumble over the words. My daughter is actually better at it than I am. She does the different voices and like she gets all into it, but I've never been able to do this.
Yeah. I find this super fun and a good evolution for storytelling in general, because like I do live stream. I do the like Pomodoros or like the co-working space. Mm-hmm. And I've gone to events where you do live readings of poetry or snippets of your book. And like, it taught me how to speak better to other people and sort of like convey what I write. And this just seems like an evolution of that, because we've got now the fact that we can live stream this, that people can access this later if they get the rights to, or if they don't get in trouble for it. But like on Twitch, for example, you have replays, so people could go back and they can listen to it again. And then you have the community aspect, because you have a chat that can be ongoing, people talking about what they're listening to, and then be able to sort of interact and sort of process it. So it's like additive audiobooks and a communal audiobook experience.
Yeah, I like about this. So I just did a conference, was it last weekend? Shout out to Confusion in Michigan, their 51st year. And they asked if I wanted to do a reading. And I'm like, no, I always say no. But because I have airway issues, I have scar tissue in my airway and repeated surgeries. Reading for me is very difficult. But I kind of like that they're like, this is human and you don't have to be perfect. Yeah. So I like that idea of it. And what I like about hearing authors read, especially when they're reading at conferences or conventions, when they have a short period of time, is how they'll kind of maybe skip over a few things and summarize. And that kind of just makes me think about my own work too and what I might be self-editing better. So I do like hearing authors read their own work.
I'm thinking about this now, and I'm kind of thinking like I would love to do this like a fireside chat kind of thing where I'm like sitting in a smoker's vest and got my pipe and I've got one of my books and I'm maybe even put on like
I'll
an
let you
English
borrow the
accent.
fireplace back there.
I should totally come to your place and do it. We're going to be mobile here in a week or so.
There you
I
go.
should do that, and because I could see I think the way I interpret this is it's basically just more content, right? But I wonder if you could just do like if I read a chapter a night every night until the book was done. So, 20 to 30 chapters, about a month's worth of reading as a live stream or something. I wonder if that would have an impact. And you could always put the links like go get the full audiobook or go get the ebook or whatever. Just have that streaming across. I think I might try this.
I'm definitely going to check them out for some of these live streamers for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and
Thanks for
like
that.
I said, the interactivity is such like a strong part of it, and I think that that's one of the big fallacies, in my opinion, about literature is that we're sort of told that this is our book and we can't talk about what we did behind the scenes or like we have to just give this to somebody and they have to interpret it at face value. But we never do that for artwork. We never do that for poetry. We never do that for dance. People are allowed to talk about what inspired them, what drew them to do those pieces, and really allow them to talk about it. So this gives that venue for a chat to react live to how you're reading it, and then for you to take a minute and if you need to, explain what drove you to do this part and really start to give more of a deeper connection to the reader of how you made the story.
I mean, even if you don't read like the whole book, like Kevin's idea, just even if you're thinking content-wise, reading a part of it and then doing that, like opening that up to that Q&A and just like, there's a lot that you can do with that that sort of encourages like a curiosity, which I think is like one of the things that makes people pick up a book, right? I mean, that's what hype is. They just are getting enough curiosity that you feel like I have to check this out. So I think that there's definitely an opportunity to use your own words and create that same curiosity.
I like it. I like this a lot. I'm going to probably do this.
Cool.
We'll see. Maybe I'll read one of JD's books.
Maybe you should have some Writers Ink guests on,
Could
huh? Well, I'll come read on your channel.
do.
That would be the fee for using my fireplace.
There you
Got to
go.
do my part.
I'll send you your book. As long as I don't, okay. I get to pick the book, though. You don't get to pick
That
the book.
works.
All right. Next up, bookshop.org. And Draft Digital partner to make self-published ebooks available through indie bookstores. Bookshop.org and Draft Digital have partnered to allow indie bookstores to sell self-published ebooks, bringing hundreds of thousands of indie titles into Bookshop.org's ebook platform for the first time. The financial model strongly favors indie bookstores. 100% of Bookshop's ebook profit goes to the affiliated indie store, making the sale, and if no store is selected, profits are shared across participating bookstores, positioning ebooks as a meaningful margin booster for indies. The move is framed as a strategic challenge to Amazon's dominance, with Bookshop noting that ebooks already account for 5% of its sales after just 1 year, proving indies can compete digitally when pricing is uniform and inventory is unlimited. Both companies see a natural alliance between the indie authors and indie bookstores, especially as self-published authors continue to drive growth in romance, horror, and fantasy. If you distribute ebooks through D2D, you can opt into bookshop.org today from your publishing dashboard. And it is very easy. I did it yesterday. You log in, it pops up. Do you want to list all your books? You say yes. Or otherwise, you can say, I'll do it one at a time later. It's very easy. This is big news, by
Can
the
you
way.
do it if you're in Kindle Unlimited? You can't, right?
No. Only if you're just if you are distributing your books via Draft Digital, which can include Amazon, but if you're in KU, you can't distribute anywhere else anyway. So this is really, really big news. It's been kind of a thorn in all of our sides for decades, really, that indie bookstores don't carry indie author titles. because they really usually can't afford to. You know, there's no returns, there's not, you know, it's all kinds of reasons why it doesn't happen. So this is a way. And if they are, you know, promoting, I think now that I am in some of these stores, I may start reaching out to them and start offering to give them swag and posters and things like that to promote my ebooks, you know, so that they can profit from those sales. Now they've got an incentive to do that.
I love all of this. I love it for indie authors and I love it for indie bookstores. You know, as we talked, we had Bob on from Good Neighbors before talking about how some publishers going direct to consumers could hurt the indie bookstore ecosystem. This is going to help it. So anything that helps indie bookstores, I'm all for that. I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm pretty connected to one of our local indie bookstores, and they always talk about Bookshop as just a secondary opportunity. We've talked about the fact that Bookshop was planning to do this almost like 2 or 3 years ago.
I
So it's really
remember
nice finally seeing it happen. And like as you were talking, I literally just did it. Like it took 2 seconds to do
that.
it. So I was
Perfect,
like, oh
Jacob.
yeah, I got to do this now.
You are famous for this. When we were at Author Nation, JP literally bought a website when someone was talking about what your website should be during that talk. He's like, I just did
You
it.
just got to do the thing right there, otherwise you
Right.
forget.
Well, I love it.
Never,
Do the
never good to
thing.
procrastinate.
All right.
We got one final news story, and then we need to
There's a
just
lot
open
of news
things
this
up.
week. Like, wow.
A lot happening in the news. This is a big publishing week. Ingram Spark announces free revisions. Ingram Spark now has no limits on revisions for existing books, and the revisions are free. Previously, updates were $25 each on books past the 60-day mark. There is a trade-off, though. While update fees are going away, Ingram Spark now has a higher market access fee of 1.875%, up from the previous 1%. The upside is more flexibility and no penalties for improving your book. The downside is a slightly higher recurring cost for global distribution. I don't know that that's much of a downside, but I will say, looping back to Draft to Digital, when I was with them and we took on Ingram as our print partner, that $25 fee was a big pain. And Draft to Digital actually started giving every author a free credit once every 90 days to do that update, and that was coming out of DDD's pocket. So this is another big one all around. It's going to be probably beneficial to DDD, which is beneficial to indie authors. So it's good news.
Agreed.
You got to say more than that. We got a whole hour to fill here.
No, we have
Let's
questions. We have questions. We have people here live in the audience, and hopefully they have some questions.
know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year? One that's almost done, but never quite gets there? Well, right now, it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis, marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane. And right now, you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book. Start making real progress, escape revision limbo, and publish with confidence story after story. Check out autocrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's autocrit.com/JD. And by the way, if you are shy about asking questions, we do have some primer questions we can ask.
And
But
I
if
do have
you,
some email questions as well
yeah, we
that
got
I
some that people have sent us.
that
So,
couldn't be here
but
at
we would
this
rather
time.
hear from you. Who among us has a question? I don't, can they have like a way to raise their hand digitally or something, right?
You just put it in the chat. Go
Yeah,
ahead.
put it in the chat.
Or raise your hand if you want to come on live and talk, and I will unmute you.
My brain's back at the bookstore thing. I'm trying to figure out how to make this work because when I've got new titles coming out, I always distribute wide for the first 90 days and then I pull them back and drop them into KU. I've got a local bookstore that works really close with me on a lot of stuff, so I'd love to be able to put some of that money in their pocket. So I got to figure out how to make that happen. Even if it's only for 90 days per title, I think it's worthwhile.
As long as it can be withdrawn. I mean, and DDD usually is pretty good about guaranteeing that. So if you distributed via DDD and you withdrew it, they are pretty good about going and making sure that it got taken down. So we got questions come in. Well, I know we have one in the, at least a couple in the comments, and we got somebody raising their hand. So who wants to do the deal? You, Christine?
I accept zero responsibility.
Yeah. Okay. Oh my goodness. Look at all of these questions. Let's start with a couple in the chat maybe, and then I will take a
look. Hey, look, we're all much taller in person. I was told I'm shockingly short, but we are all taller in person.
You are shockingly short. Jay, I'm going to unmute you if you want to come on and ask your question.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Nice to meet you. My question is, how do you determine whether an idea for a story has enough substance to become a full-length novel or might be more suitable for a short story?
That's a good question. I'm going to let JD answer first.
That's easy. You write the story, and yeah. If it's 80,000 words, you call it a novel, and if it's 10,000 words, you call it a short story.
Yeah, somewhere around the 120,000-word mark, I realized that my latest short story was probably a novel.
That's honestly what always happens to me. Like I start writing it out thinking that it's going to be a short story, and then it ends up growing up into something else. Yeah. But I think for a lot of these, you know, you get the idea down on paper, and like once you get past that initial, you know, big moment of the, you know, getting that idea revealed, you know, like it's difficult to determine whether it's going to be, you know, something you can stretch on because you hit that muddy middle. And you know, like if it's a book, you know, you've got to fill all that, and a lot of short story ideas just don't have the kind of legs that it takes to do that. Yeah. So I mean, before I write anything, I try to come up with a beginning, middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. And that usually dictates it, at least in my head, how long it's going to be. Point of view, you know, if I've got multiple point of view characters and stuff, it's obviously leaning towards novel. Things like that.
So JD, have you ever started a novel, gotten to the muddy middle, realized it was probably a short story, and revised it down?
I haven't for a very long time, but when I first started really writing fiction, I did a ton of short stories for magazines and newspapers back in the day. And I had two of them that basically started getting too long. I think one hit like 23,000 words. And then I started thinking novel, but then I finished it and it still only ended up around 40,000 words. So ultimately we ended up releasing it as a serial novel, but through a magazine. So it came out, I think it was like four or five different issues. They just kind of split it up. But otherwise I've never really had that happen. I love the idea of writing short stories, but, and I always tell myself I'm going to find the time to do it, but I've never actually made the time to write short stories. I can tell you King, like Stephen King, like he writes short stories on Mondays. So like every Monday he spends on short stories. The rest of the week he writes on a novel. And that kind of balances things out, or like, that's what he used to do. I don't know if he's still doing that today, but like something like that to me,
that's an idea.
Yeah. That kind of makes sense, you know, cause I'd have to force myself away from the book in order to do it.
Yeah. I do think that, outlining also helps with that. Like, you know, I mean, even going beyond the beginning, middle, and the end, like that, you know, that's part of outlining, but like, obviously if you're kind of tracking something down, you can start to tell, are you really having to like really dig to make those plots, you know, go the distance or not.
Yeah.
The more you think about a story, I think the more obvious like it kind of becomes on what length it's going to end up being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Short stories, I think, tend to be more viable than a lot of authors think out of the gate, because, you know, there used to be tons of markets for them, and then those markets dried up. So I think a lot of people stopped writing short stories.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can put them up on Amazon at 99 cents a pop, you know, and sell a gazillion, you know, in little amounts. From a film and TV standpoint, they're priceless. Like if you can put out a collection of short stories, there's a good chance you might have two or three different things in there that get optioned, you know, instead of like one novel, which is just, you know, just the one book can get optioned. But like I've got friends that have collections of short stories, and like half the stories in those books have gotten optioned for film and TV.
Yeah. A good practice actually. And I've done this in the past. I need to do this again, but you know, for a while I was posting a lot of shorts on Amazon and elsewhere. And then at the end of the year, I'd collect them all into like a collection. And so now you get multiple books for the price of, you know, a handful of short stories.
Yeah. If you did that too, like if you have a Substack or something, you can, you know, put them on there. And then like you said, at the, you know, at a certain point now collect them and you have an anthology that you can sell. That's
yeah.
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
I would say like to your question of how to determine, well, you know, is there enough substance? I think trying what they're saying, like trying to start with a short story, see if it fits those parameters. Like for me, I think that I grew the most when I started writing short stories and then realized that I had more substance to put in there. My short stories, I was following a method that basically was like, if I can put it into five chapters, the first chapter being that conflict, the thing that describes what's the turn, what's the thing that happens. And then we have some like choice that needs to be made that happens at some point. We have build up in two of those chapters and then the fallout in that fifth chapter. And if it fit in that, then it was a short story. If it didn't fit in that, all of a sudden it's like, oh no, this is becoming longer than it needs to be. And that's when it's like, okay, this is a novel. It really, the short stories, I think I wrote four or five of them before I was like, okay, I've got an idea for a novel. I know that it can be much longer than the parameters of a short story. So there's the substance. But it took the practice to do it.
Yeah. This was just very similar to one of our email questions, which was, at what point in the conception or draft process do you know whether a book is going to work? And I think it goes for me, what Jenna was saying about outlining. First of all, I write the back of the jacket blurb. JD made me do that. And I have carried that over to see if it's a good concept, talk to some people about it. But I really do like outlining to see if the story's going to work. Because if I outline it and I'm like, this doesn't make any logical sense, then I'm probably not going to spend, 9 months to a year of my life trying to make it work. So I know. Okay, I'm just going to go in order of the questions that we got here. All right, this one's from Sam. To everyone, out of all the episodes, who has been your favorite guest? That is such a tough one.
Ooh. I have mine. I know mine.
Okay, go, Kevin.
Right off.
You go first.
My favorite guest was Orson Scott Card, the guy who effectively was the whole reason I started writing fiction in the first place.
Fair.
So
the fair answer.
Yeah. And I have JD to thank for making that happen. So thank you, JD. He's become a good friend of mine now. We're having another call like tomorrow.
Yeah.
Ooh, fancy.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
I don't do any of the interviews, so I've got the easy part.
Yeah.
I mean, if I don't say Patterson, Patterson will get mad at me. I mean, he's like, when he comes on, though, he's always just full of really, really good advice. I think for me, just getting Kuntz on that one time, like that was a huge win.
Yeah.
Because I've been talking to him for years and he's always been giving, he's one of those guys that I've always gone to for advice. And like, he just knows everything about this industry. So just getting an hour out of him was fantastic. Karen Slaughter is always good. Like we've had so many good ones.
Yeah, Karen still has my favorite piece of advice, which is, if you think a bestseller is a piece of crap, take another look and figure out why it's a bestseller. I mean, yeah. That really has changed my perspective. I got to shout out Ewan Morrison because we became friends after we chatted, and we still have chats and offer each other advice. And I appreciate community. So
I would say mine was probably Hugh Howey. He was just so generous with his time, and like, he was so easy to contact and talk with. And then his insight into characters, and if you don't know your character, ask yourself what's in their pockets. And that's just such an easy, quick question, and then it sort of defines. Yeah. And so like, that was just such a fun thing. And then like, he's just such a humble person to talk to. So
yeah, he was my favorite. Yeah, he's super nice. JP just slid up in those DMs.
I can't pick a favorite. I can't do it.
Can't Matthew pick a favorite child, Jenna? Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey was all right.
Yeah, yeah.
You're trademark. Not allowed to say that anymore. Didn't he trademark that?
Oh, yeah. I didn't do it in his voice. So.
Nice. Oh,
we have a comment from Philip, and I just have to read this because it just made me laugh out loud. And that's why I was laughing in a way that was not appropriate for whatever Kevin just said, because I was reading comments. After meeting you all at Author Nation, I learned you're all much taller in person.
Yeah. See?
Yeah.
How tall are we? Jenna's not tall.
Shorter.
Jenna's not tall.
But I was wearing twice the pants that I am wearing now. So I'm.
Did he meet Jenna? Warning. Maybe he met the rest of us.
Yeah, hi. Jenna's not tall.
Yeah, he met the whole group. He came around to our booth and everything when we were at the Reader Nation thing.
I guess maybe Jenna was sitting down or something.
You know, I am probably average. Okay.
There's nothing wrong with being short. Embrace
You're
it.
Missing the whole thing. Okay. He thought she was like micro. That's what he thinks. Oh, like she God. Looks like she. Look at her. Look how much headroom she has in the frame right now. Well, there's like a whole other person there.
Oh my!
When you God. Take the when you take the subway, do you have to duck under the turnstile? Like, are you able to, or can you just walk? Like,
she has to be careful not to slip through the gratings and stuff.
Oh yeah. My God!
Yeah. Ha ha ha.
And this is the abuse that gets cut out of the podcast.
I won't tell any Oompa Loompa jokes from Charlie and Chocolate Factory.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, Brandon, I think you are next with your hand. I'm going to ask you to unmute and come on and ask your question.
Hi, everybody. A great show. I really enjoy listening to you guys. I was curious to know if you were to... So I wrote a nonfiction probably in 2011, and I'm getting ready to... I'm working on my second draft of my first novel, and I'm debating, should you... consider those like Writer's Digest contests, or if you were in that position, would you at this time think about submitting to a contest or looking at like trying to find an agent or doing self-publishing? If you were starting at that point in time, what things would you consider when making that decision?
Oh my goodness.
I need more information. What is the nonfiction project about, and what genre are you writing in fiction? Like, are they related in any way?
Okay, so not at all. The nonfiction was it's called The Mormon War. It's kind of about the history of Jackson County, Missouri, which is where I live, and I just got access to a bunch of documents through the Missouri Attorney General's office, and just kind of researched it and wrote it. My novel is I'm looking at it as like a young adult. It's kind of like a Princess Bride meets Treasure Island meets I've done a lot of historical research about the 9 Years' War, and so it's going to follow a 14-year-old kid from Scotland who's the cousin of Captain Kidd, and kind of interweaving a fictional character through Captain Kidd's life in the Caribbean, fighting the French and things like that.
Okay. I mean, if that's the case, I would honestly, like, I always encourage people to take the traditional route first. I think it's important to experience all that. If you can get a book published in the traditional world, you know, you can see exactly every step from start to finish over those first couple of years. And I think it's good to have that knowledge in your toolbox, you know, if you decide to go the indie route, at least to understand the entire process. I would probably query agents on both of these projects, and I would probably query them both separately, as if, almost as if you're two different people. And I'm not saying use a different pen name or anything, but I would query the nonfiction project and the fiction project totally separate from each other, and see if either of them lands, and then follow up from there.
And maybe I should clarify, the nonfiction has been published. It was published by Westholm Publishing out of Pennsylvania somewhere. And I actually had that's on contract with them. I don't actually control the rights to publish it now. It's with them. But I don't know if I can call those back either. So that would be interesting.
So I will say that that makes even an even stronger case to query the fiction and, you know, make sure that you mention, even though it's nonfiction, I'd make sure to mention that you've been published. It does give you some street cred, and, you know, list that book out, say, hey, I had a nonfiction published, blah, blah, blah. You know, anything you can do to kind of show that agent that you are, worth the investment of time, you know, and energy. I don't know, JD, how you feel about this, but my thought is that, like, if I were going to submit something, I'd give it a timeline on how long before I decide I'm just going to self-publish it. But that's because I self-publish first. So I don't know if that's a wise idea from a traditional standpoint. And I think it really just comes down to what kind of career are you looking for? You know, how much control do you want to have? Does it matter to you? You know, because self-publishing can be a long tail kind of thing. It can take a long time for something to kind of take off and for you to actually, you know, succeed at it financially or otherwise. Same is true for for traditional publishing, but if you do manage to land a deal, it can give you a lot more traction in the future. I don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't see it as an either-or situation. Like, I think you need to query agents. If you get a bunch of rejections, I think it's important to figure out why they're rejecting you, and see if it's a problem that can actually be fixed, because a lot of times it can be. If you're getting a ton of rejections, there's a reason. And if you can weed that out of the book, that's going to obviously make the book that much better. I don't think anybody should self-publish or indie publish unless they could have gone the traditional route and just choose not to. They could have gotten a traditional publisher, they could have gotten an agent, the book is that good, but they decide to put it out on their own. I think that's kind of important. I personally mix it up quite a bit. I've got indie published, I've got hybrid titles, I've got trad titles. They all land in different places. They all get, like some the trad titles, you can find them in Costco, you can find them in Target, you can find them in Walmart. You're not going to find my indie titles there, but you're going to find my indie titles in a lot of places where the trad market doesn't necessarily touch. So I use it all as a means to just get in front of more and more people. So I every time I've got a book ready to go, I always, look at that book and, decide like what is the best means of publication for this? What's going to put it in front of not only the largest audience, but hopefully an audience that I haven't touched yet, and so I can rope in some new readers into my overall fold. So I use every aspect of it to try and basically broaden my readership.
Yeah. And I think, Brandon, you had asked about contests first. And I think there are a lot of great contests out there and people who have gotten great traditional publishing deals from contests. You just have to do your due diligence.
By the way, you're not limited. You can do contests and
While you're
start
querying,
querying for agents.
absolutely.
I wondered about that. That's a great point. Thank you.
They tend to not want, you'll hear people say not to, double up on queries, but this is kind of different because it wouldn't do anything but benefit that agent if that thing did suddenly land, a contest. A lot of times those contests come with representation. You have the option to be represented by somebody as a result of it. The thing is, you got to be cautious about the contests, like really vet them, because there's so many out there that they're really just a money grab. Writer's Digest, I trust a little more than others, but I mean, I'm still wary about. I used to submit to contests all the time, and I've won a few here and there, but it's never benefited me all that much, other than maybe put a few bucks in my pocket.
But you can use those things though, like in your query letter too. Like if you get long listed or short listed, it's just communicating to the agent that obviously like other people have seen
Plus, it
your
lets you put award-winning novelist on your stuff,
well
which is
So I mean those are nice to put even in your even just the query letter if that's all it does, like it helps, I think.
As my like minor soapbox alternative option, because I started self-publishing because I was in a room with a bunch of indie authors, and I think that that was the reason why I started self-publishing was because I had access to other authors. So I think that regardless of the path that you choose to take, whether it's trad or self-publishing, get yourself around a group of other authors so you have connections, so you can ask them questions. Is this a good contest? Is this a bad contest? What would you suggest otherwise? All those sorts of things are so helpful. And I think that I consistently hear from a lot of people that writing is a solitary practice, and I vehemently disagree because I think that there's so much to do with connectivity and communication and being able to have a community of authors around you to ask questions to help you grow.
Bah, I'm here by myself. I love it.
We're all fake, and and Kevin's just here with
None of
us.
you people, you're all just digital noise to me.
That is
Thank
how
you.
Kevin truly feels.
No
We're
problem.
all living
Thank
in
you all for
Kevin's
your
world.
advice. I really appreciate it. I thank you very much. That means a lot.
No problem.
Absolutely.
Sure thing.
All right. Brian, did you want to ask live?
Yeah, thank you all for the time. I love hearing listening to your podcast while I'm out on my route. So my question is, I think I already know the answer. I just wanted to get your all's opinion on it. And it's about like, so I'm effectively trying to be like a modern C.S. Lewis of writing Christian living books and also writing fiction books. But the difference is, my fiction isn't going to be Jesus in your face like C.S. Lewis's books were. They're going to be more so like Christianity or whatever moral stuff is more going to be like in the background, and I'm just focusing on like making the story happen. So,
yeah.
Like my first book just released on Amazon Saturday called Individual Christianity, and it's you're responsible for what you believe, not the guy behind the pulpit. But like my next book is going, my novel I'm trying to work finish is like Narnia with animorphs, and there's dragons in it, and it's Narnia if animals actually fought like animals. So it gets very graphic, very dark. And so should I worry about readers from one audience carrying over to the other, or should I just write the book and let the audience find the book?
I know my take.
Yeah, I mean, I've always approached this as from a brand standpoint. Like, you have to build an author brand, and the big portion of that author brand is the author voice.
Yeah.
One of the things that the advice I got very early on, because I wanted to bounce around in genres, was to make that clear from the get-go. So if you go to my Wikipedia page says I'm a suspense author, and I may include elements of horror, sci-fi, this or that. Suspense is my common thread. So every novel has some element of suspense, but I can branch off in all these other things. And as long as that common thread is there, I find that the audience comes along for the ride. If it was, you know, totally different, completely out of left field and completely different type of book, I don't know that that would work. But you know, it's important, I think, to do it from the very beginning. I use this story a lot when I do talks in front of writers groups. But like I got this advice from Dean Koontz. He told me to bounce between genres. You know, so I ended up writing a horror novel, then a thriller novel, another horror novel, and went back and forth. Patterson, you know, like his first book that hit was Along Came a Spider, you know, serial killer novel. So then he churned out three or four more of those exact same serial killer novels, and then he got bored with it, so he wrote a book called Maximum Drive, I think it was, about a girl with wings, which was so different that his fans completely pushed back on it because they weren't expecting it. But if he had done that as a second novel and then bounced back to a serial killer and back and forth, I think the fans would have been a lot more understanding. So yeah, it's good that you're doing it from the get-go. I think it sounds like you have a bit of a plan together. I think you just kind of need to keep that in mind and figure out long-term, you know, this is where you are on your second book. Where do you see yourself on book 10? And try to map out, you know, that strategy and, you know, just fill in the blanks as you go.
Yeah. That's something I'm actually grappling with right now, Brian. So I appreciate the question, because I think we've talked about it before. I started in serial fiction, pen named on Kindle Vella, and did sci-fi adventure. And then, you know, kind of raised my hand when JD needed co-authors and said, I'll write a serial killer thriller, which is like way outside of anything I had ever written before. And so now I'm trying to figure out again, where am I writing? I'm kind of writing in that thriller space and that sci-fi space and seeing if there's overlap and blend, but it's a bit tricky. So I do think it's branding. Like, how can you find the commonality between what you're writing and, you know, is that close enough for the audience to cross over between one and the other?
I will clarify too. I'm trying to take a Joanna Penn's model of like using separate author names. So like The Christian Living will be under J. Brian Wright and my fiction will be under J.B. Wright to kind of get like a name separation between the two.
I think that's great. Yeah.
So my only caution on that is that it's two separate brands, and it means that you have twice the brand work to do, twice the marketing, I'm not advising against it. You just need to know up front. One brand may gain traction. You might have to pick and choose your darlings at that point. I purposefully decided early on that I was going to do probably a little bit more of a Dean Koontz model. Like I've written cross genre my entire career so far, and I'm just going to make that even wilder in the coming books. But I think it does come down, that whole brand idea is the point. You could potentially marry those two pen names under one brand. If kind of a J.D. Robb kind of thing, I think that's the author, right?
That's Nora Roberts.
That's
Nora Roberts.
That's what I was going for. So it's not a secret at all that J.D. Robb and Nora Roberts are the same author.
Yeah.
But when she writes one type of fiction under one pen and another under the other. But her fans come to both.
Yeah.
I've read both. I think most of her fans probably do. And maybe there are those who prefer, you know, the J.D. Robb books over the others. But there's going to be a growing crowd of people who just follow her. So what you might do is just focus on creating brands for those, but do all your marketing and everything don't make any secret of the fact that this is you.
Yeah.
Especially since it sounds like your nonfiction and your fiction have a related theme. You know, it's not going to jar anybody for you to kind of switch gears.
Well, I think like with Joanna, you know, she has Joanna Penn and the it's a JF Penn, I think. They're so close that it's no secret. And I think you've done the same thing, Brian, which I think is smart because, you know, people go to your website and you can have them on the same place. And there's that separation of the two names, but, you know, it's the same author. So I think that's
smart. I have another pen name that nobody knows that makes a lot of
money. I'm going to find out one day.
We are going to find it. We are.
All right. Thanks.
It used to make a lot of money. It doesn't make much money now.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Brian.
You all.
Malcolm, did you want to come on live and ask, or you just want me to read it? You know, come on live? Yeah. Okay.
Well, thanks. This is a little intimidating as you are all heroes of mine. So,
well, we are judging you.
Yeah.
So I thought you would be. That's why. Yeah. But I'm planning on publishing my first novel this year. And for those of you who have been in the industry for a long time, if you looking back to before you published your first book, what would you change? If you could change anything, what would it be?
I know I personally wouldn't change anything. I mean, I spent 2 decades working behind the scenes as a book doctor and a ghostwriter. And like a lot of people have asked me, like, what would have happened if you started publishing books in your 20s instead of my first one came out when I was 43. The truth is, I don't think the books would have hit as well as they're hitting now because I needed that 20 years of a learning curve behind me to really figure out what I was doing. So I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah.
For me, I love my early work, but I would have written... I learned a lot later that I wish I could go back and apply especially in terms of consistency. I would write more early. I would write more books than I wrote earlier in my career is the only thing I would really change.
I would have waited longer to publish because I did have a book, the very first one that I just wrote with a friend and we threw out to 2 small publishers and one of them picked it up and then they're like, I would have waited longer. Like I think about Josh Malerman, who I think was at Bird Box was like his 20th book that he wrote or something. Yeah. And then he had all those books in his back catalog that he could call upon. I wish I had more books in my catalog, but now, you know, I feel like I'm in a good place going forward. So I just have to write fast, which is.
I would buy Apple stock. That's the change I would make if I could go back.
Yeah. Genius.
Yeah. JP, anything for you?
I don't know because the first novel I had published was in 2021, and it was a dark paranormal academy. So clearly now I write cozy queer fantasy, which is a totally different story. So I think if you were to ask, like, if I knew the genre I wanted to write in and it was the first time I was publishing that specific thing, because I like the social media aspect of things, because I would have researched that more, I would have made more connections with people directly in that genre and worked on how to build that platform, just because right now that's where my headspace is at. I'm very much on the social side of things and like pushing and just really truly understanding the fact that you are your only and loudest advocate at first, and you will still be your loudest advocate at the end of the day. There can be lots of other people that join in, but like you have to kind of fake it until you make it, more or less, right? And I think that having that mindset and just accepting the fact that like you have to be proud of the work that you put in, regardless of if there are so many things that you'd like to change about it, and really stand by it and really shout about it. If you're going the self-publishing route, obviously, if you go the trad route, you have a little bit more backing, but still, I think you are your only strongest first advocate.
Yeah, I think even I don't even know if it's one over the other, being your advocate, because you really have to be an advocate for traditional publishing. I think that is something that some people think isn't as relevant, but I don't know, it might even be more important that you really make sure that you are advocating for yourself.
I just want to pull out a couple other questions that are related to this since we're going on with it. What adjustments are we making, if any, in how we write or conduct the business end of our books based on the shifts we've been talking about on the podcast in the book industry? I think that's an interesting one. Are you making any changes based on the news we all talk about. I mean, for me, it's been a social media push this year, which is something I've never done. I'm doing like recording videos of me talking on social media, which
I love them.
I hate, like, I, you know, I'm so introverted. When JD was like, we're going to put Writer's Ink on YouTube, I was like, oh my God, no, like, people are going to see my face. So I guess that has actually helped me with this on social media. But social media has definitely been an area I've been trying to hit more. Maybe now live streaming book readings. I don't know. What about you guys?
Ooh, I'm so excited, Christine. Yeah. I love this journey for you. It's been so fun.
I try.
I've got a silly change that I made that has nothing to do with the news that we read.
Yeah.
But it had a lot to do with me listening to my own audiobooks. So I stopped putting the word chapter in my chapters. So like it no longer says chapter one.
Oh, so it's just like one.
And I started putting the number there. And mainly because when the narrator reads it, it sounds really obnoxious when you've got a lot of short chapters. You know, if they're constantly, like certain things work on paper that don't work as an audiobook. You know, like in my 4MK series, I have not only the chapter, but I also have the point of view character, their name is there. And then I timestamp each chapter. So at the start of every chapter, it's like chapter 23, so-and-so, Tuesday, 4:13 p.m. you know, which when you see it on paper, you just glance over it and it helps you keep everything organized. But when somebody actually reads it aloud, it's different. So I've actually been working with recorded books. They do all my audiobooks and giving them a different draft for the audiobook versus the print, where I strip out certain things that I just don't feel need to be, you know, read out loud but do work well on paper. So I guess that's a slight modification I've made.
Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah. That is interesting. I never actually thought about that. I guess usually when I listen to audiobooks, they're sort of more like those longer chapters, sci-fi or fantasy, and I didn't notice it. But yeah, you're right. It would maybe sound a little odd with those very short chapters, particularly with thrillers, because you really want to keep that tension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Okay. I have a couple more email questions. So yeah. I think we still have a little bit more time. So let me throw out a couple of these. What skills do you think authors will need to develop in the next 5 years?
Well, I mean, let's just get it out of the way. They need to know how to use AI.
No.
Take a drink.
Oh.
It is true, though. Every author needs to know how to use AI ethically and effectively. I do advocate against using AI to do the actual writing of your book. But you'd be a fool to not use AI for other aspects of the work. Helping with the marketing is just right off the top of my head, one of those. But even using it for things like just kind of analyzing it to help you figure out whether, you know, you've gone off the rails or not. JD and I have had conversations about this. You know, just plugging your manuscript into like Claude or Notebook LM or something like that to get an overview. You can't just flat out trust it. You still got to use the AI in your skull to really kind of analyze that, but learn how to, you know, leverage that to get you thinking about the book in ways that you may not have thought of before.
Yeah.
It's a good skill.
Don't you think it'd be better to use, like, I don't know, like the tools that are in like Pro Writing Aid or AutoCrit, where that you're at least not using your manuscript to train the LLM. Like, I mean, I get it. Like,
Claude, I don't have any problem.
Like, I don't know. Yeah. I'd rather use a closed system that maybe it's technically AI, but it's not actually.
Yeah.
God knows what those big companies are doing with. I don't know.
For real. I'm with you on that one, Jenna.
Okay. So yeah, there you go. I mean, if that's what you feel, then, you know, there are specific tools that can help you do that. But I don't have a problem with it and don't see any alarm over it. So I use ChatGPT mostly.
There you go.
I'm really careful with it just because I have a lot of conversations with foreign publishers and the rules are different in literally every country and they're changing just as fast in, you know, some of these other places as they are here. And Kevin, I listened to the Wordslinger podcast. So I was actually ready to throw my phone across my gym while I was listening to you at one point. So let me ask you a question. So if you use ChatGPT or whatever one, it gives you one solid gold sentence that you really love.
That's
and you
right.
drop it in your, you drop it in your book. Now, when you upload that book to Amazon, are you checking off the little box that says you used AI?
I will not. Do you check off your box if you use a sentence that other humans have used?
It's not the same thing. It's not asking me if other humans.
It's not.
Amazon's not asking you if you.
And, you know, and first of all, I don't think I've ever done that. But second of all, you know, that's not the definition of using AI to generate the work. If you borrowed a sentence from AI, there's nothing about that means you used AI to write it.
I guess the danger.
Well, but Amazon's not asking you what percentage of your book was written by AI. Yeah. They're just asking you whether you used AI in the creation of the book.
Well, I'll just go on a limb, and I'm not an attorney. Don't follow me for legal advice. I would absolutely 1000% never tell Amazon that you used AI in any aspect whatsoever on your book. It's only going to come back to bite you in the butt. So that's a Kevin Tomlinsonism.
Well, my big concern, the reason I'm bringing this up is, you know, in talking to these foreign publishers, this is still working its way through the court system in literally every country. And right now, there's no real definitive answer as to whether you can have AI content on any level in your book. And at some point, that is going to come to a head. The Supreme Court in the U.S. is going to rule on it. You know, their counterparts in other countries will rule on it. And depending on where that lands, you know, if you have AI in your book and they decide that you're not allowed to have AI in your book, they can pull those books. You know, Amazon is collecting this data right now so that they can, you know, basically have a list.
Even more reason not to say anything.
Well, it's not going to be just about saying anything.
A lot of those things can become public.
Okay, but they're going to get... Okay, so the problem is they're not going to be able to scan, first of all, with any accuracy and determine that you're using AI. They may false flag on you, but that's going to happen whether you did or not.
AI records, they can. If your user data gets released and it's in there.
Well, I'm on the record saying don't use AI to write the book. But if I use AI to help me with editing the book, well, how's that using AI to write it? There's no AI content there. It went over my content.
Ethics, please wave in. I don't know.
Tell you what, I'm going to do it my way. You guys need to do it whatever way you feel is safest. But I'm 1000% sure cautious. I'm going to come out on top.
Kevin's a cowboy.
Thank you. We do have a lawyer in the audience who says there is software that scans documents for use of AI. So if you don't disclose, there could be serious repercussions if you're required to disclose and have a false answer. We use them for pleadings in court. Thank you.
that's kind of where I was going with this. And I'll add this one point so we can close out the topic.
Yeah.
What's going to end up happening here is, you know, foreign publishers, people that are actually, you know, bankrolling these kind of things, they're going to run these books, any book, through whatever system they feel is necessary to check it. And if you get a false positive or positive, it's not going to matter because they probably won't publish the book even on a false positive. You can plead your case, but they're not going to take that risk.
Yep.
It's best just to steer clear. And I think it's a slippery slope. You use one sentence, you know, on this book, the next book you're using a paragraph, next book you're using a chapter. It's a very slippery slope.
Yeah. All right. I think we started a few minutes late, so I'll just want to ask one to close out. This is mine. We always ask our guests what advice you would give to new or aspiring authors. I just want to know what advice you give that's personally hard for you to follow. I'll start with mine. Mine is don't care what your readers like, you know, don't pay attention to what your readers think, and there you can't control that, so don't worry about it. I do worry about it. Even that, so there's the advice I give myself that I can't take.
I mean, I read all the reader reviews on Goodreads that I see, basically, so good or bad. You know, and if it's a bad review, I try to pull whatever I can out of it to see if there's justified, if there's something worth tweaking. I think any kind of feedback is useful. Yeah. I mean, the advice I tend to give everybody is just write every day. I think that's probably the most important from what I've seen. You need to be consistent about it. That's the only way you're going to get better. And it's the only way you're ever going to really finish. You know, you'll eventually get a book done, you know, if you're writing every other weekend or whatever. But, you know, if you really want to take it seriously, I think it's one of those things where you need to do it every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard for me personally to follow, but I do agree with it. I try, but that one's probably the hardest.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that, like, push yourself if you're able, but don't have the guilt if you're not, because the guilt doesn't do anything, right? It doesn't help you move forward. It just makes you feel like crap. And I think that, like, Well, I love and agree with the notion of write every day, and I think that that's a good standard to try and push yourself towards. If you have a means in which you literally cannot, except for maybe 10 minutes a day or something like that, where you could fit those in, like there is always that risk that someone will just feel guilty and they'll crumble and they won't be able to do it at all because they're like, well, if I can't do it every day, I'm not a writer. Mm-hmm. And I think that like we have some of these like quote unquote golden rules that exist that only exist for like 90% of the population. So I think that like I sort of like don't have the guilt is the big thing for me.
All right, great. I guess I should ask JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Benjamin Hale coming on. Benjamin's writing has appeared in Harper's Magazine, Paris Review, the New York Times, Washington Post, and many others. He teaches at Bard University in Columbia. He's got a new book coming out called Cave Mountain, A Disappearance and a Reckoning in the Ozarks, and it's based on the real-life disappearance of his cousin. So that should be good. Benjamin Hale.
All right, sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.